Welcome to The Image Doctors, episode number 35. Today's March 1st, 2007. I'm Jason O'Dell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
Thanks for joining us again today as we delve into the world of all things Nikon and Nikonians. And we've got a pretty full show today with a bunch of topics. Why don't you start us off with what we're going to cover, Rick?
Well, the first thing that we're going to do, and actually the first two topics came out of some listener email. So mm-hmm. Once again, we do appreciate those, and you can send them to us at talkradio@nikonians.org. But the first two topics are on Nikon remotes and basically, you know, what are out there, what are good choices that are cost effective, things of that sort. And then we had a question on neck straps and options there, pros and cons, benefits, things of that sort. And then we're going to talk a little bit about Lightroom, which is a new program that came out from Adobe here just about a week or so ago. And we'll talk a little bit about what I've been playing around with it for a while in the beta form, and now since it's out in version 1.0. And this is kind of following up our RAW converter topic, although it does a little bit more than that. It's a fairly full-featured kind of thing.
This isn't our full review, though.
No. This is just a preliminary.
It came out. We wanted to point that out, and mm-hmm. you can tell us something about. Mm-hmm. Did you update to the full version?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
I never did that.
Yep. And then finally, we're going to have a little bit of a philosophical type of discussion on workflow and what's going on with RAW converters and some of the other tools out there, where they headed, and some things that you ought to think about, you know, when you're selecting some of those.
That's why PhD is Doctor of Philosophy.
I thought I'm it was authorized. Piled higher and deeper.
That's true, too. That means I'm authorized to philosophize on this show.
Oh, God.
No. That's why we're the Image Doctors.
Yeah.
Always full of expert advice.
Yeah.
And stupid ideas.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
A plethora.
Okay. Cornucopia, I believe is the word. We got an email from... we'll start with an email we got from Christian Falster. He wanted to know about... Nikon remote cords.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we just overlooked it, but yes, we keep them in our bag, especially for when we're doing landscape work.
And use them frequently.
Yeah, I just used them last weekend. And there's a couple of different flavors. All of these remotes from Nikon that work on the, what I'll call the modern cameras, are electronic releases. They're electronic remote cords. The old days of a mechanical cable release have pretty much gone away.
Yeah, those were inexpensive, which was nice, and didn't really fall apart too often, but they've kind of gone by the wayside.
Unless you broke the pin off inside the shutter release, which could be a real problem, but that was a rare occurrence.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on what kind of camera you have, you're going to... will sort of dictate the kind of remote cord that you would want to purchase. And the reason you use a remote cord is to keep your camera perfectly still when doing tripod work, so that you're not bumping the camera when you depress the shutter. It's as simple as that.
Right. And it really does make a difference too. Even if you're extremely careful and you're doing a long exposure and you're pressing down in the shutter release, you'd be surprised at how much vibration and movement can be transmitted into the camera, and it can affect the sharpness of your image.
And I'll usually use mine in conjunction with mirror lockup. If I'm doing slower shutter speeds, I'll press first to lock the mirror, and then the second press opens the shutter.
Yeah, and I'll do that too. Now, keep in mind, not every Nikon camera has a mirror lockup, so it's, you know, typically the higher end ones
right.
that do. But if you have it, it can help.
Yes, it can. And the other area where you might use a remote cord is for long exposures, where you set the camera on bulb, and then you hold the cord down and you count off time,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, use a stopwatch or whatever you want to do. And that's where some of the differences come in with the features of the different remote cords.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be you could get a cable release for about $8 to $10 or less, depending on where you got it from. Remote cords for the modern cameras start at $25 and go up from there to $100, depending on which one you want. So there's three remote cords that we'll talk about because probably you'll find yourself in one of these camps. There's something called an MCDC1, and that works on your D80 and D40.
I think that's it's a new cord. It wasn't out before.
And it's a very simple push-button release, but it has a lock, so you can do a timer. You can lock it and walk away from it if you wanted to do a really long exposure. Mm-hmm. And we looked it up at B&H's website. It was $25 and change, $25, yep. $26.
Quite a good deal.
So it seems pretty reasonable. You can also use the infrared remotes. If you have a D70 or a D50, D40 or D80, there's a little infrared wireless remote control that you can use.
Yeah. Now, those are the only type of remote that you can use with something like a D50 or a D70. But they were very popular. Mm-hmm. You know, people that had them loved them. They're tiny. They're cheap. They slip in your pocket. And
you don't have to screw them in when your fingers are cold in the right, early morning, right. Which can be a problem.
Right.
If you have something like a D1 series, a D200, or a D100, D2, mm-hmm. Then you're going to have two choices in remotes, and that's either the MC30. Actually, you have three choices. We'll start with the MC30, which is the least expensive option.
Yeah.
That's the one I have.
Right. And one quick comment, we can also extend that out further to things like the F100, the F6, the F5.
Right.
You know, all of the more recent film autofocus bodies.
They have a 10-pin remote connector.
Right.
And you unscrew the little cover, and unless you have an F6, you unscrew that little cover, and then you promptly lose it. Mm-hmm. But here's a tip. If you ever lose that, you can call up Nikon, at least in USA, and tell them that you call up Nikon tech support and tell them that you lost it. And a lot of times they'll send you one for free. Mm-hmm. Replacement. I did that with my F5 a long time ago. Yep. So that was just a nice little thing. Mm-hmm. Anyway, your cheapest option here is the MC30, and it costs about $55 from B&H, so it's a little more expensive for something that's just a switch. But it does have a lock switch on it, and I want to say the cord's about 3 feet long. So you can use the button. You can hold the button down and lock it, walk away from it, do time exposures that way. And then... and you're good to go. That's what I use, and mm-hmm. it's fine.
Yeah. The one I have is one that was discontinued just a little while back. It's called an MC20. Honestly, when I bought it, I wanted to buy the MC30 because it was cheaper, and it did everything I really needed it to do. But I was on my way on a trip, and I had to stop by a camera store, and all they had was the 20, which at the time I think cost me about $80 or $90.
And that's been replaced, right?
Yeah. It had an intervalometer feature in there. I've never used it, actually.
Yeah.
So, oh well.
So the MC20 has been replaced by the MC36, and we looked that up, and it was about $130 at B&H.
Ouch.
Yeah. That's because it has a LCD display on it, mm-hmm. Not to show your images, but to show things like the time. Mm-hmm. It has an intervalometer on it, so this you can set it up to take a picture every 5 minutes mm-hmm. if you want to walk away from your camera, and you do that. Depending on what camera you have, that's either really important or not at all important.
Because it's included in several cameras.
Right. I know the D2X that we use has an intervalometer mm-hmm. function built in. You just have to go into the menu.
Yeah, so, F6 has it.
So for some of the earlier film cameras... that didn't have a built-in intervalometer like the F5 or an F100, then if you wanted to do that kind of shooting, you needed to buy that remote
right.
to do that. So that's sort of the state of the situation with remote cords.
Yeah. My advice would be go simple unless you're really convinced that you need the intervalometer feature.
I can't find a real... I don't think I've ever used it other than to see if it worked.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've never used it. So what the heck?
Yeah. So thanks, Christian, for that suggestion. We appreciate it. And that'll bring us to our next topic, which is camera straps.
Mm-hmm. And I think that came from Klaus Jessen.
Yep. Thanks, Klaus. He sent us an email a while back. And Klaus basically wanted to know, have we replaced our neck straps with something different from the Nikon supplied neck strap. Mm-hmm. And I still have the neck strap from my D2X sitting in pristine condition, unopened.
Yeah, ditto.
The best part about the Nikon neck strap is that it's bright and yellow and it says Nikon D2X on it, which is also the worst thing about it because it advertises expensive camera here.
Yeah. they're better straps than the ones that you used to get a long time ago, which were plastic or thin leather things. They're also certainly better than the truly tacky things that used to be around in the 70s that were several inches wide and usually had
multicolors,
you know, flowers all over them and, you know, looked like you could carry them into the disco or something like that.
We had one. It was like suede on the one side and it was red and blue and white with a pattern on it.
Yeah. Had all these huge metal buckle things.
You know it.
Scratch the heck out of everything. Yeah. So they're better than that, but they're a lot less desirable, in my opinion, than what you can get with the neoprene straps, which is what we both use.
Right.
And there are several ways that you can go there. Optek is a company that is very well known for their neoprene straps, and those are very comfortable, very nice. If you want to support our site, which is a great thing because it helps fund things like this, you know, and paying for all the downloads and stuff like that, you can get the Nikonian's version of the Optek strap, which advertises that you're a proud member of our community.
Mm-hmm.
And with all of those, they're very comfortable. They're just wide enough that the weight is distributed across a broader area. They're not so wide that they get in your way. They have a very nice cushioning built into them so that when you're walking around and carrying your camera, it really takes a lot of the shock out every time you take a step. And if you have a heavier camera with a big lens on it, that's really important. They have little quick-release clips so you can take the strap off in just a matter of seconds if you want to. Sometimes that's nice for packing.
Or when you're on a tripod, yeah. That's when I use it.
Yeah, a very worthwhile investment. The one other kind of strap that I use, and it's on some cameras that I have that are smaller and lighter, like I've talked a little bit about the X-Pan panoramic camera I have, and I have a strap made by Domke that's on there. It's a wider strap. It's not the neoprene material. It's only about an inch wide, though. And the thing about it that is nice, you know, if it's not a really heavy camera, is it's got some rubber strips, long ones that are built into the strap, and what those do is they kind of hook it onto your shoulder, and it's a lot less likely to slip off. So if you're, you know, taking around a camera that's a little bit lighter, it's not a bad option.
Yeah, I guess I was going to point out there's two different philosophies on straps. I mean, the Optek strap that I use is really designed to be a neck strap, not a shoulder strap.
Mm-hmm.
It has some non-slip material, silicone beads on it. But because it's wide, it will slip off your shoulder if you're not careful,
mm-hmm.
especially if you've got a heavy camera. Now, if you have a heavy camera, you probably don't want to put the strap on your shoulder anyway. So we recommend using the Optek type strap as a neck strap and not as a shoulder strap. If you want to use a shoulder strap, you're probably using it on a somewhat lighter camera. There's another manufacturer that I've heard makes really good straps. It's called the Upstrap.
Right. We tried one out at last year's PMA.
And it's a really nice lightweight design because the strap itself is mostly just nylon webbing. So real strong nylon web. It's got very strong connectors on it. And then it's got a solid rubber pad that grips onto your shoulder. So mm-hmm. that's the wide part. So the part that's actually on your shoulder is you know, an inch or two wide. I think it's about an inch wide, maybe a little wider than that. And then the strap itself is very compact, small because it's thin nylon webbing. And those are very strong, and they work, and they hold on your shoulder much better. And that's designed to be used as a shoulder strap.
Yeah, and it is quite amazing. I mean, you really have to do some, you know, put your shoulder at very extreme angles to get it to slip. In fact, I think when I tried it, I just pretty much couldn't get it to slip off.
Right. I know when I interviewed Arnold Crane, that's the strap that he uses, and mm-hmm. he swears by him, and he's an old school photojournalist, and he's yeah. always carrying two cameras, you know, one on the shoulder and one.
Yeah.
He swears by the Upstrap. He says it's the best he's ever come across. Mm-hmm. So that's a thing to look into as well if you're mm-hmm. not into the big fat neck strap.
Okay.
All right. Well, moving right along, you're going to tell us something about Lightroom.
Yeah.
Because I haven't really used it at all. I tweaked the beta, but it was so beta at that time that I just haven't had time to keep trying.
Yeah,
too many software products.
Yeah, there are a lot out there. That's for sure, and they're constantly changing. I've been playing with Lightroom since it came out in beta for Windows. If you recall, it came out for the Mac before that. But when it came out on Windows, I started using it. So I went through, several beta versions of it, and then 1.0, the real release of it just came out here over the last couple weeks. And since I had a license for Raw Shooter Premium,
that's right,
which was purchased by Adobe, I ended up getting a free license for Lightroom, which was a very nice thing. That was a classy thing for them to do after they purchased Raw Shooter. And so here over the last week or so, I've been loading my images into its library and working with it a bit. And I can't say I've used all the functions in it. There's some that I've just used in the betas so far and not in the final version. But I can give you some initial thoughts on it. And I would say overwhelmingly, my thoughts are pretty positive on it. The when in a previous podcast, I was talking about what I did with images coming back from the trip that my son and I took to Eastern Europe. And how, in a situation where I had a large volume of images that I was doing raw conversions on, which is not my normal situation, I found myself preferring, as I had in the past, using something like ACR for the conversions over InX, just because it is nice for, high volume stuff, even though I don't like the individual conversions quite as well. It's a situation where convenience wins out.
Stepping back for a second, mm-hmm. Lightroom is one of two products out there that is designed to be the full, complete, all-in-one workflow solution.
Mm-hmm.
You can use it with Photoshop, and I know it'll integrate with CS3 when it comes out. Mm-hmm. But if you were to walk into the store and say, why would you buy Lightroom? It's because it's going to do all of your image management, raw conversion, a fair bit of editing and printing. Is that right?
Yeah. And to pick up a little bit more, about what I discussed with that trip, I talked about the workflow I used for that and, downloading the images and then going through a process of applying some metadata templates that had, the copyright data and basics about me and things like that in it. And then, putting in keywords, which I did via Bridge, and then doing the star ratings and things like that, ranking, figuring out which would be the keepers, and then doing the raw conversions for those keepers, not messing mm-hmm. around with the others, and finally getting them into TIFF formats, etc. And Lightroom, picks up, that whole process from when you ingest it into your computer initially off of the card, to doing the metadata, the keywording. It handles the raw conversions, and it uses the same functions and sliders that you'll find if you've looked at the CS3 beta version that's out there. And we also talked about that in a recent podcast. And those are a nice set. They're definitely a step up over what ACR had in the past, which was a little bit too rudimentary for my taste a lot of times. And the things that I specifically like in Lightroom and the CS3 beta are the highlight recovery slider, which is independent of the exposure slider, so you're not messing up the overall brightness of your image if you're trying to pull back detail and burned out highlights. Very nice and handy feature. And then it's got the fill light feature, which just boosts up the light level in the lower mid-tone area. It's a feature that was in Raw Shooter before. Also very handy. It's something that you might not use quite as much as highlight recovery, but when you need it, it's nice. And, some pretty powerful curves types of processing, and, it's pretty slick. The things I've seen so far, still a little bit buggy, just like most 1.0 versions. I've had some problems with keywording and dragging and dropping there and a few other things in that area. Performance is a lot better than the betas, which is good because it was fairly sluggish at times. I think it's going to be a good product, and I can see myself using it instead of Bridge and ACR for you know, the higher volume stuff. Mm-hmm. It's just very quick and convenient. The conversion quality is also better, in my opinion, than the CS2 ACR converter. You know, a little bit nicer. It's easy to set up presets. I set up a whole bunch of them, so I can have something that looks like the Mode 3 color palette in X, and you know, all the usual handy things in terms of different tone curves and different chromatic aberration removal settings for specific lenses and noise reduction settings and things like that. But so far, so good. It's got, you know, a very nice print module. We'll talk more about that later probably, and stuff for putting things out on the web in specific formats, you know, creating a gallery quickly and easily. It really is targeted against situations where you would be shooting very high volume and need to get raw images out there quickly. Now, like, you know, some other recent converters, including NX, you can also use it to process JPEGs and TIFFs, and you see the exact same kind of sliders and everything.
So this is your all-in-one, one-stop mm-hmm. shopping workflow solution.
Yeah, and non-destructive edits.
That's always good.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's in a lot of respects an Adobe version of Aperture,
right,
but it does have some twists and does have ultimately tighter integration with Photoshop here in the future with CS3.
Yeah, I was going to mention that the other product that is the all-in-one workflow solution would be mm-hmm. Aperture, which is only available to Mac users because it's an Apple software product, and I've played around a little bit with it, mm-hmm. and I think the features that it has in terms of the sorting are really excellent. They're
ditto with Lightroom. Very powerful. You know, if you've put in your keywords and stuff, it's very, very easy to get selected subsets of images and stuff like that to work with. So I like what I see so far. You know, I'm going to continue playing with it and getting the rest of my images in there. I've just done a partial set, but I think it's a nice product and worth playing with. And if you do have a raw shooter license from the past, you should have gotten an email here over the last week with a serial number for Lightroom, and I would recommend trying it out. I think you might like what you see.
So that'll bring us to our little philosophical discussion of workflow, because there are some limitations with these all-in-one products, and there's a bunch of different ways you can approach workflow. And while Rick and I share some things in common, we also have some differences. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that we just dress alike.
We have the same camera equipment pretty much.
Yeah.
But there are some differences.
But I've taken a slightly different tack I've looked at a lot of stuff, and I think workflow is one of those things that is still evolving. And I think workflow is a very personal topic. I don't think that any one person can come up to you and say, this is the right way to do it, this is the wrong way to do it. Mm-hmm. What you're doing is, you know, right or wrong. If it works for you, great. Now, there's certainly ways to streamline it.
Right.
But the big deal with workflow is getting something that works for you, that you know what you're doing, and stick to it. And don't be... I mean, I think part of the problem that I have lately is that so many products keep coming out and you can't try them all. You can't do everything. You have to decide what is important for you in your workflow. And that brings us to this idea of starting with how you shoot. Do you process lots of volume, high volume images? Do you only process a few images? Do you work in JPEG? Do you work in RAW? You got to take all these things into consideration, and what tools you choose to implement your workflow will be in part dictated by your personal preference on style and format that you shoot.
Yeah, and one thing I think is worthwhile talking about first is don't overdo it either. Especially if someone is relatively new to digital and they're pretty enthusiastic about it. You know, the temptation is to go out there and get a bunch of books, read a bunch of articles, and get, you know, a fairly elaborate software setup with lots of, you know, keywording and, you know, all sorts of fancy things set up in there and cataloging. And while that can be very good, and for some photographers, it's practically essential, it can also cause a lot of pain that you may not really need. If you're only shooting, you know, maybe once a month, once every couple months, and doing mostly family photos and nothing that's too terribly intense, you might get by just fine, frankly, with just a very simple file directory structure. And you could have a file directory called Christmas 2005 or Hanukkah 2006 or so-and-so's birthday, you know, 2007. And
my family's got a few so-and-sos in it.
Yeah, some so-and-sos, yeah. So the point is, if that works for you and is adequate, then don't worry about it. Just be happy, because that's going to keep you from some additional workflow steps. It'll keep you from buying some additional software packages, and life is good.
And one thing to keep in mind, that there's a lot of overlap between some of these software packages. So you don't have to go out there and buy every single one of them.
Right.
Because you'll find that they do a lot of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
The 30-day trials are really good for that.
Right.
So now, back to our philosophical discussion. You and I both have sort of adopted the RAW workflow.
Yeah.
Now, with a JPEG workflow, that's probably the easiest workflow, because pretty much any product out there is going to read a JPEG. Mm-hmm. And what you see is what you get.
Mm-hmm.
The limitations of it, as we've talked in the past, is that you have, you set yourself up for destructive editing. The settings that were in the camera at the time are kind of baked in. You can't necessarily fix those. If you have radical adjustments to sharpening and you save the JPEG and you save it over the file, you don't save a copy of the file, you can end up with degrading your master files. So a JPEG or a workflow that's based on a real RGB image format, and by RGB image we mean things like TIFFs or JPEGs, mm-hmm. or that kind of stuff. That's where I started, really, because I scanned slides. And so it meant I scanned a slide at a very high resolution, 4,000 lines per inch. And then that was my master, and I'd save that somewhere. And then maybe I'd work on that in Photoshop and make a master processed version of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know a whole lot about adjustment layers at that time, but that's something that you could do to aid in keeping things from being... it's a form of non-destructive editing, doing things in adjustment layers. And then I would resize a version for maybe printing at a certain size, and it would be sharpened a certain way. And that would be the 8x10 version. And then I'd make an 800x600 pixel sharpened another different way version of that master to post on the Nikonians forums. And so I'd have a lot of different files floating around, and you have to really keep track of them. And they were all in some form of RGB format. That was before I started shooting digitally and moving into RAW.
Mm-hmm.
Started shooting RAW, and at the time, that was, 2 years ago now, almost? For me, it was process the NEF into a usable RGB format, initially with ACR or Nikon Capture 4.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I started using Nikon Capture 4 only because at the time that was the only thing that would read the D2X files.
The white balance
yeah. stuff. But ACR was quickly updated, and you know, I played around with both. So then the RAW file was the master archived file. It would be saved with an instruction set either from Nikon Capture or from ACR and converted to a TIFF, like a 16-bit TIFF. And then I'd work on that 16-bit TIFF just like I would if I had my scan.
Mm-hmm.
The difference was that I could adjust more of the parameters in that RAW phase before the image really came in into the RGB format. So I'd mm-hmm. start with a better quality TIFF file, if you will,
right?
Than I might have gotten otherwise. And then still have your versions, and you save it different file sizes. And I think that I was reading Tom Hogan's ebook on the D2X. He talked about his file hierarchy system, and I think he had at least 4 copies of every file of every image that was important to him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's the real trick. It's, do you do this to every single image? Well, that's part of your workflow, is to be able to download your images and look at them and judge which ones you're going to use. If you're a photojournalist, it might be all of them because you're going to send them to an editor and they'll make that decision for you.
Right.
In which case you want something that's streamlined. You're not going to necessarily be shooting NEFs. And then lately, I've sort of changed my workflow a little bit because I've been tinkering around with Capture NX so much, and I like certainly what it does in terms of RAW conversions, but it did something, and I realized this sort of after I had been using it for a while, but it was at the when it came out, it was the only RAW converter that allowed you to do local editing on your NEF while it was still technically a NEF file. It's, I mean, it converts things to RGB data to be displayed on your screen, but you could still save the file as a NEF. I didn't have to save my changes in a TIFF.
Right.
I could save the changes in a NEF, and I could use something called versions. This is also in Capture 4. I just never used it. There's a thing called versions that allows me to save the same file in different ways and have it all packaged into the NEF. And that meant that I didn't need four copies of every file anymore. I have one file, the master NEF, maybe an archived one somewhere mm-hmm. just as a backup, but my one file could hold everything that I used to use four images for. And it holds it in a more compact file size because the NEF is just Bayer data mm-hmm. and then an instruction set on how to process it. So by way of comparison, if you shoot a compressed NEF in a D2X, you'll get a 10 or 11 megabyte file. And that's the NEF. You take that compressed NEF and you save it as a 16-bit TIFF file, which is how you would normally do it if you're going to send it to Photoshop or wherever mm-hmm. else. That's a 70 megabyte file now because it's RGB, mm-hmm. all the extra channels. Go from a one-channel NEF to a three-channel RGB file, it gets a lot bigger. So I'm trying to, you know, in the interest of saving space, it's a lot easier for me to back things up onto a DVD if they're 10 megabyte or 20 megabyte files than, and in retaining maximum quality, than if I'm putting them into 70 megabyte TIFF files or something like that.
Right.
And then that doesn't even begin to get you if you start adding adjustment layers or other layers in an application where each layer might add to the file size. You can easily come up with a, you know, 150 megabyte PSD file mm-hmm. if that's what the way you work. Now, there's nothing wrong with doing that.
Right.
You know, there's no one right way here. I've just found that and I've been kind of enamored by it. But it creates a set of limitations on how I have to approach my workflow.
Yeah. Now, in my case, I do like NX and I like it for color palette. Although, you know, you can configure things like Lightroom and ACR mm-hmm. so they come close. It's not exactly the same, but it's pretty close. I like the local edit feature, you know, with the color points and stuff like that. I found that to be pretty powerful. That's not the only kind of local editing that I end up doing on files, but it's certainly very convenient. But what I've ended up doing is, and partially this is out of habit, I suppose, but there's some other reasons for it too. I've ended up creating those derivative files, you know, the TIFF files or PSDs, and PSDs are what I use more so because of the fact that you can put layers in there. And so once I've exported it out of NX and I've got it in a file format like that, you know, I'll usually do, you know, some additional dodging and burning in some cases, which in some I do prefer at times in Photoshop. Mm-hmm. Just a little bit different kind of approach with masking and things like that. I like printing from Photoshop.
Yeah, I do too.
You know, just because there are some very good sharpening tools that optimize stuff for different printers and papers, and those are good. And, you know, just to be honest, I mean, Photoshop's got tons of features and it's quite powerful. I only use a subset of them, but the subset I use, I like, and you know, plugins can be quite cool. There are a lot of them available for it. So for a number of reasons, it just ends up being easier for me to go the TIFF or PSD route because of those steps and wanting to have something that I can be edited in Photoshop. The other thing too is after I'm all done with those edits, and maybe I've got a whole series of PSD files. You know, let's say I've gone on a trip, and maybe I've processed most of them, you know, with ThinX or, you know, pick a tool, and I've got all these TIFFs and PSDs now. One of the things I do like is being able to use the image processor function in Photoshop and just have it, you know, do a batch conversion on a whole bunch of images and be able to specify easily the size of the image, both horizontal and vertical, and compression ratios for JPEGs and mm-hmm. destinations, and just have it go off and do things and use some of those plugins for sharpening and things like that as part of that big batch job. It's just awfully easy. Create a whole bunch of JPEGs that go on my website, or that you know, you can do TIFFs that way too, if you're just coming from the RAW converter.
Now, here's something I guess I kind of omitted a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of, my workflow, I don't, it's not that I never make a TIFF or a PSD file.
Mm-hmm.
I just might not keep it.
Mm-hmm.
What I'll do is make a TIFF or use OpenWith from NX and send that TIFF converted RGB file to Photoshop so that I can do sharpening for the print or... But if I don't do anything beyond that,
mm-hmm.
and I'm just going to use Photoshop to print it, for example, I may not keep that TIFF file around.
Right.
Now, if I've cloned things out or if I've done some complex things, sure, then I have a new... Because that represents the new master file. And if I need to use a Photoshop tool, I'm not going to get around that. I have to convert right. it to something first.
Right.
Cloning
is a good example of a situation where I'd want to have the TIFF or PSD coming out.
But I'll tell you,
Linux.
I don't clone nearly as much as, you know, I used to think it was really cool. I'd go in and clone things out and it ended up messing up my image more often.
Yeah, I don't do a lot of that either at all. I just don't care to, but I'll do it for dust spots
yeah. you know,
when they show up.
Yeah,
not a big
absolutely.
Problem, but it does happen on occasion.
So,
but I guess, you know, talking a little bit about that, my philosophy on the TIFFs also is that normally I'm going out on a shoot and I'm just doing something with a small subset of the images coming off of it. It's not a whole bunch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you won't have 100 TIFF files, right?
No. So if I've only got a small subset of TIFFs or PSDs and they're big, that's okay. Hard drives are getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, both as primary and backup devices. So I don't tend to worry so much about that. And so far that's just been fine. You know, the subset of images that end up in those formats isn't that big. And sometimes, like with the Europe trip that I just mentioned earlier, I didn't even really create TIFF images at all. From that, for the most part, I was able to do my edits just in ACR, and I don't really have a whole lot of problems with dust in general.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I did is just use that image processor to go straight from either NEF files or DNG files. I played around with those a little bit, right over to JPEGs. Never went through the TIFF option, so I ended up with something that was fairly compact, and that worked well for that. So. Any rate.
So what I see is this. Mm-hmm. I mean, things are sorting out with software.
Yeah.
You got a lot of options out there, and there is no one right choice. But I see it this way. There are a lot of applications on the image management side.
Mm-hmm.
Let me stop for a second, and let me go back. No matter what you shoot, everybody needs to do a few things that are... You're always going to do the same thing. Regardless of what you do with your images downstream, there's some stuff in the workflow that you're always going to do no matter who you are. You're going to copy these pictures somewhere onto your computer from your camera,
right.
And you want to make sure that you can find them later.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to want to sort through and examine images, whether it's to rate them, keyword them, or whatever, or just determine which ones are the keepers
mm-hmm.
and which ones you're going to process further.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to want to have them stored somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're going to want to go into the process. So that's the front phase of your workflow.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the middle phase of your workflow, which is the actually processing images. And then you have the output phase of your workflow. We've talked about that before. It's
printing
it, sending it to the web, putting it on your website
right.
or whatever. So the important thing to keep in mind is that there are a lot of different raw converters out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we've reviewed Capture One, and we've talked about DxO, we've talked about Bibble, we've talked about Capture and NX and ACR, and all of those products, whichever one you like, you use that one. Okay. But what you prefer to use has some consequences in what you might want to use for that front end side of your workflow.
Yeah.
And that's what we're starting to see, where the cataloging. And I'll give, and here's the reason why. More and more software companies and computer, software manufacturers are touting the ability to process raw files from within their application. Great. Nothing wrong with that. But here's the catch. It processes it using whatever engine is supplied with that application. iPhoto or Aperture on Apple's side uses Aperture's rendering engine. And that's how it generates the thumbnails for your NEFs. And that's what it uses to produce JPEGs from. And that's what it uses to email. And that's what it uses to do slideshows and all those things. There's nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
The catch comes when you're trying to integrate a workflow with one of these raw aware products. I'll just call it raw aware. And use an external raw converter. If I take an NEF and I put it into Lightroom or Aperture, Lightroom or Aperture processes that NEF. And I can make the adjustments there if I want to.
Mm-hmm.
But if I take that same NEF and I process it in Bibble, get it the way I like, bring it into Lightroom, those changes aren't recognized. Same thing with NX, same thing with DxO. You know, I have to first, if I'm going to go that route, I need to first create those RGB files and bring those into my library program.
Mm-hmm.
Or I have to just say, I'm going to use the library program that has the raw converter in it as my all-in-one solution. So you just have to be aware of these limitations. One thing about Aperture that I like Aperture. I think it's a really cool program. But if you want to process your NEF externally, I can't just say open an external editor. It's going to convert it first to a PSD or a TIFF.
Yeah.
And it sends NX or Bibble, it sends it a TIFF file. Well, that's not what I wanted. I wanted to process the NEF from scratch.
Right. And Lightroom does the same thing.
It does. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's just it. There's nothing wrong with that approach. It's just they're built for a different intent. They're built for you do your basic conversion up front here, and maybe you send it into an RGB editor like Photoshop for final tweaking.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different rationale. If I take that NEF file that I've processed in NX and I re-import it into Aperture, I won't see anything. So for people who want to choose that workflow, you need to find yourself a browser program that fits the bill. And by fits the bill, I mean it'll possibly show you and use what you've done in your raw converter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know how all the raw converters work, but I'll just stick with what I know, which is NX. NX puts a JPEG into your NEF.
Mm-hmm.
There's always a JPEG in your NEF. That's when you shoot RAW on your camera. RAW is RAW. It has to be converted to something. So your camera stores a small JPEG in there of that image. And that's what is used to make the histogram and, see it on the back of the screen. NX embeds a full size, high res JPEG. And that's why your file size gets bigger when you save your NEF. Goes up a couple of megabytes. It's because it's a bigger JPEG in there.
Mm-hmm.
Some programs will use that embedded JPEG for the preview, for the thumbnail, for your emailing, for your slideshows, and will also possibly give you the option of converting the RAW if you so choose. iView Media Pro is one example. iView Media can use Apple's built-in RAW engine, for example. Same thing with Photo Mechanic. But you can also disable that feature and say, create thumbnails and do everything from the embedded JPEGs.
Yeah.
Now, that has streamlined my workflow from that perspective. Because when I want to email somebody, I don't save a separate file. What I do is I go into NX, and most of the time, it depends on how lazy I'm feeling. If I want to send something right, what I'll do is I'll create a version in NX that is the small, properly sharpened web size image. And then I'll just save that nef. I know I can always go back and undo that at any time and make it bigger again. Then when I'm in Photo Mechanic, it uses that JPEG as the starting point for my thumbnail, which is an 800 by 600 pixel image. That's the last way. That's the way I saved it. So when I say email, it just brings that into the mail, and there's that image, and it's sharpened properly, and it has the nice feature of converting to sRGB or whatever. And everything that I've done in my external RAW converter, because that JPEG was embedded in that file, displays in my Photo Mechanic browser. And iView does similar things, I believe.
Right.
So those two programs, if you're using something like NX, where you know you're going to get a JPEG embedded in your image, those are very friendly to use. If you're using a RAW converter where you end up converting the image to a TIFF file or a JPEG, then it probably doesn't, you can use whatever you want.
Yeah.
As long as you're saving your image as an RGB format. So it's sort of a different philosophy of which one you might want to choose, because Lightroom is more than a RAW converter. It's a, it is an image management solution.
Right. Now, one of the things that we ought to point out when you're looking at different tools and stuff is thinking about compatibility. And I'll just use the simple example of using some sort of a rating system like stars. If your browser may have a star type of rating system, and superficially it may look like the one that's in your cataloging program, and it may superficially look like the one that's in your RAW converter, but in fact, they probably don't talk. And that's a very frustrating thing. If you're using a package for just a portion of the process. And I think that's one of the things that is attractive about some of the all-in-one solutions is that you don't have those speed bumps in the process. And in some cases, there are tools that you can buy to bridge the products. Good example is from Bridge to iView Media. You can get a thing called Rank and File, which will do some jury-rig things to translate stars from one program over to the other. So if you rate something as 3 stars in Bridge, you'll see 3 stars in iView Media Pro, but there are lots of things where that doesn't work. And it's just something that you have to think about in advance. You know, are they completely compatible in terms of those kind of things? Because when they're not, it gets frustrating and irritating.
I think Photo Mechanic may be trying to work it to make their rating system compatible with the one in Bridge.
I don't think it is.
It might not be right now, but I think it's one of the things that they're working on developing.
Yeah, that would be a great feature.
And that's the thing. So,
And of course, the other things that you can get into are issues on, you know, how are your edits in a RAW converter saved? You know, Adobe's proposed the DNG file format, which is supposed to be a little bit more of a universal one. Although, at least from what I know and looking at the spec, I think it kind of forces you into using its specific settings and sliders. So if you're a company like Bibble and you might have some additional features above and beyond that, which you would like to have saved, you can't use just that format to do it, at least from what I can see, or it's awkward. And, you know, that there really is no universal solution right now, unfortunately. It's, you know, hopefully something that we'll work more toward in the future.
Yeah, and this discussion could go on forever, so we're just going to shut up right now.
Yeah, one last thing, and then we are going to shut up for certain. Where are things headed, though? You know, let's talk very briefly, just in the next 5 minutes, about trends in the industry. At least from what I can see, I think we're going to start seeing, I think the all-in-one solutions are a powerful trend right now. And I think it's going to get harder and harder for single-use packages to compete with those, although there's still going to be a role for them, but it's going to get harder. I think the localized edit feature that's in NX, I think that is absolutely a trend, which we're going to see popping up in other converter packages. It's just way too powerful to not go that way, especially with a related trend, which is non-destructive edits and not having to go to a TIFF file necessarily if you don't need to. So in, if you're going to really take full advantage of that, you want to be able to do localized edits. So the equivalent of NX's control point feature will show up, I think, in lots of others. There's just no way it won't. And there are lots of rumors about that going on in case of certain packages.
the ability to save an edited RAW file without having to convert it all the way to an RGB format is that trend that I'm seeing.
Yeah, and multiple versions. Right.
I think that's wonderful. I can't believe I never took advantage of that more often.
Right.
And that's the version thing has something to do with our weekly prescription.
Okay.
Which I can need for Sudafed right now.
Yeah. Other things out there that I think are trends: automation in terms of noise reduction and sharpening will be something that shows up more and more. There's just rudimentary automation right now, ISO specific settings and things like that in some of the raw converter packages. I think that'll improve chromatic aberration removal. Some packages like NX, Raw Shooter in the past,
DxO,
have more automated CA removal. Some have a more manual process. I think they'll all end up with something automated.
So I think that trend of doing so much more to the raw file while it's still quote raw is what we're going to be seeing.
Yeah, I absolutely believe that. Okay, you mentioned a tip.
Yeah, I have a little short, a quick tip, our prescription of the week. And it's an NX tip because we've been talking about it a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it has to do with what I was saying about a little bit earlier about, I see a lot of posts and a lot of questions about people saying, geez, I used NX and then I saved my file and it got huge.
Mm-hmm.
Well, huge is relative.
Yeah.
I still say I'd rather save a 20 meg NAF than a 130 meg layered PSD. But that's a different story.
Mm-hmm.
The issue was, what I mentioned is that Capture NX embeds a full-size, high-resolution, high-quality JPEG to replace the JPEG that was initially embedded in the NEF from your camera.
Mm-hmm.
This is both a blessing and a curse, depending on how you look at it. It's a blessing if you have an application that allows you to extract that JPEG. I know that I don't have to save a JPEG. I can extract a high-res, full-size JPEG just from Photo Mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that it increases my file size by a couple of megabytes. Mm-hmm. That embedded JPEG is 2 or 3 megs in size. And that can be pretty noticeable if you're shooting something like a D70 and all of a sudden you add a couple of megabytes to your RAW file. The way around that has to do with versions and has to do with saving your NEF. And so here's my workaround if you wanted to say archive a bunch of NEFs and get the smallest possible size after saving in Capture NX. After you've gone through your NX workflow, what you should do is save a version called master, and that's your full size NEF.
Mm-hmm.
Then apply a resize step, a size resolution step, where you shrink the file to something manageable, like, 1024 by 768 or 800 by 600.
Mm-hmm.
This is just an edit step in NX. It's completely non-destructive.
So you could have that set up as a settings file, right?
You could set it up as a settings file. That's right. And in fact, I have some like that I use for web. I have one for landscape orientation and one for portrait orientation. Mm-hmm. But that last step, it resizes my NEF, only in terms of the way it processes the image. And then I hit, I create a version called, I save a new version called small.
Mm-hmm.
And that's version small. I save the NEF now at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Whichever version was active when you, at the time of saving your NEF, is the one that NX uses to create the preview JPEG.
Mm-hmm.
So now instead of creating a 4,000 by 2,200, 12 megapixel JPEG image, I've saved an 800 by 600 JPEG image. So instead of increasing my file size by 3 megs, I increase it by maybe, 300K. That's the tip. You can use that when you come back to your file. If you've archived them that way, maybe you burned them to a DVD or something. All you have to do is go to the little version icon, go back to master.
Yeah.
Or just delete the edit step that you did, the size resolution step, and your file goes magically back to being full size.
Right.
And you have all the information there.
Right.
So that's what I think.
Cool.
Hey, don't say that word. Dana's going to email you and say, don't use that word, Rick.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
that's all for today. We've rambled on quite enough. So thanks for listening. Send us your comments, as always, to talkradio@nikonians.org.
And also take a peek in our podcast forum. It's the podcast feedback forum. And we do get questions and comments in there, and we'd love to see more. So please take advantage of it.
Yeah, we'll address, if you, we'll not only answer you in the forum, but if it's a good question, we'll try to answer you in an upcoming episode.
Yep.
Thanks a lot, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.